Welcome to College Land, the podcast featuring untold stories from higher education. I'm Nan Enstad in Madison, Wisconsin.
I'm Lisa Levenstein in Greensboro, North Carolina. We're here to explore life inside our nation's colleges and universities and to track some of the major changes that are happening.
We do this by sharing stories about the people who work there.
Today, we'll share an interview with Rick Hart, a student at Morehouse College in Atlanta, about his work getting out the youth vote for the presidential election. Morehouse is an HBCU, and we'll discuss the role these institutions play in the higher education landscape.
We will end with a segment we call Office Hours, in which we respond to listener questions. Today's question is about plans announced by Google to offer a 6-month training course that will prepare people to take jobs at the company. Google says that students who enroll in their training will not need to get a college degree in order to work there.
Oh, I have a lot to say about those plans.
Listeners, if you have something to say about Google or about anything you hear on today's show, or if you have questions or ideas for us for other shows, we want to hear from you. Our email is collegelandpod@gmail.com. You can also reach us on Facebook and Twitter at collegelandpod. Now on to our show.
The 2020 U.S. election was monumental for so many reasons. A record number of voters cast their ballots by mail, and Joe Biden won the election with more than 81 million votes, breaking the record previously held by Barack Obama for the most votes ever cast for a U.S. presidential candidate.
There are a lot of groups that contributed to the Biden victory, including Black women in the South or Indigenous voters in states like Arizona. But this election also saw a surge in youth voter turnout, including on college campuses. The state of Georgia, which surprised many of us by flipping blue, was a critical site of get out the vote efforts. Georgia had the highest youth vote turnout of any state, with people between the ages of 18 and 29 making up 21% of Georgia's voters.
So for today's show, we're presenting an interview I did a while back with Rick Hart, a junior at Morehouse College who served as the co-chair of Georgia Young Leaders for Biden and was the HBCU outreach director of the College Democrats of America. Rick played a really crucial role in flipping Georgia blue, and so we wanted to learn more about it.
Rick talks about how the pandemic and the killing of George Floyd really changed the landscape of voter mobilization in Georgia. He also reflects on what it means to attend and be doing this work at an HBCU.
And so we thought we would take a minute just to discuss why the role of HBCUs is so important in the higher education landscape. HBCU stands for Historically Black Colleges and Universities, and there are about 100 of them across the country today, including schools like Tuskegee, Hampton, Howard, Spelman, Bennett, and the one that Rick attends, Morehouse. The majority of HBCUs were founded after the Civil War to provide higher education for African Americans. It was a time when most colleges in the country refused to admit Black students.
HBCU students have had a huge role in our nation's story. Students at HBCUs sparked the sit-in movement in the 1960s. North Carolina A&T students sat down at a Woolworths in Greensboro, North Carolina in 1960, and the movement spread to Fisk University in Nashville, Tennessee, and many other schools. HBCUs nurture Black achievement and provide a place that's free of the kind of racism that students find elsewhere. They have a distinctive culture as well. You may remember that Beyoncé celebrated this culture when she performed at Coachella in 2018, and you can still see that performance in her movie Homecoming. She showcased the drum corps, the cheerleading style, and Lift Every Voice and Sing, which is also referred to as the Black National Anthem. And we saw the Howard drum corps escort Kamala Harris to the inauguration on the 20th in Washington, D.C.
That was such a great moment. And you know, the nurturing and pride provided by HBCUs has launched so many Black leaders. It's not just Kamala Harris, but the many people in politics, the arts, law, and social welfare. Martin Luther King Jr. began his education at Morehouse. Other HBCU graduates include W.E.B. Du Bois, Medgar Evers, Oprah Winfrey, Spike Lee, and Senator Raphael Warnock. In the interview, which we recorded before the 2020 election, Rick also talks about what it meant to him to have an HBCU graduate as the vice presidential nominee. So let's listen.
Rick Hart, welcome to College Land.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me, Lisa. I'm glad to be here.
In an interview you gave in late September, you said, "I don't usually cry, but I've cried 3 times this year." What prompted the tears?
Absolutely. Answering that question, I cried at the death of John Lewis, with the death of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and shortly after George Floyd was murdered in Minneapolis by law enforcement. Those 3 moments, I feel, are so emblematic of this year, just the tumultuousness, the turbulence, the level of how trying this year has been, how emotional this year has been. They were breaking points for me at 3 separate points, and kind of inspired me to become re-engaged, to continue to protest, to ensure that I went and voted, but took along friends and family with me, throughout the course of this last year. And in doing so, I'd like to think that we made some positive societal change, or we've taken some steps to move in the right direction to forge lasting change.
There's also been a more joyful moment that you've spoken about, and that was when Kamala Harris was named the vice president on the ticket. And you had the opportunity, I think, of meeting her at one point. And you've spoken about what it means that she graduated from an HBCU. So as someone who attends Morehouse College, can you tell us what it will mean to have a vice president who is an HBCU grad, graduated from Howard? And why is this HBCU experience so meaningful?
So I'll start with the last part of the question first, in the sense that why is an HBCU so meaningful? And I give tours on the campus of Morehouse when we're, this has been a virtual semester, but when we're physically on campus, I give tours to prospective students and their families who are looking to commit to attend Morehouse going forward. And one thing that I always say is that in an HBCU, and try to throw a Morehouse swing into this, you know, these institutions were made for us. We could not attend predominantly white institutions until midway throughout the 1960s. It's only been 50 years or so on a national scale. And these institutions that were founded by freed slaves along with religious leaders in the American South shortly after the Civil War were our only options for education at one point. These institutions were built for people that look like us, that have the experiences of us, that are Black and brown. And, you know, that's why I think attending an HBCU is so critically important, especially in this period of time that we're in right now. A place where it's like a home, a place of shelter with all the divisiveness, the racistness, the level of racism, and just it allows you to escape from that and bond with people who you have so much in common with. And then going transitioning to speaking about Vice President-elect Harris being on the ticket and being an HBCU grad. It goes to show you that people who have had the same experiences as you, people who have had, who look like you, people who attended similar institutions, that you can rise to the highest levels of the political sphere, in this case being the vice presidency. And we see also in people like Stacey Abrams, leader Stacey Abrams, and hopefully future Senator Reverend Raphael Warnock, that she's not alone. She's taken some HBCU grads with her. And it goes to show you what you can one day accomplish staying on this track. So it's so inspiring, and it's just powerful. You feel empowered by witnessing this moment.
You've been mobilizing voters for almost a year now. In February, you were getting up at 6 a.m. to campaign. What made you decide to get involved? And can you tell us a story or two about those early months of campaigning before the pandemic hit?
What propelled me to get involved was in high school, I attended a conservative Catholic private prep school on the west side of Baltimore. I had a great experience prior to that 2016 election, and then my life fundamentally changed. People who I thought were friends kind of showed me who they really were. People said things to me. I'd never been called the N-word until after that election. And, you know, watching my day-to-day life along with the world change, was kind of like an indicator for telling me that I needed to do something. I went down to Georgia in the fall of 2018 in the midst of the governor's race, Kemp versus Abrams, and felt a sense to get involved on that race because of Stacey Abrams preaching against voter suppression and talking about how we need to expand Medicaid in Georgia, talking about infrastructure improvements to Atlanta, all these issues, student loan debt, which she suffered from herself. You know, her speaking to these issues that I felt were so real got me more engaged in the process. I volunteered for her, did everything we could for Stacey Abrams. Obviously, we came short, you know, due to some factors that happened along the way, voter suppression, machines going down, things along those lines. But it was very special to me to be able to be a part of that campaign. Then flash forward to fall of last year, I joined the Biden campaign first as a volunteer. And I joined the Biden campaign. It was a strategic decision because I felt that we needed to pick the person who could beat Donald Trump. Ideologically, I had so much more in common with Senator Sanders, Senator Warren, Andrew Yang, and others. However, I said that we can't mess this up. We have to pick the right person to be the nominee, to beat Donald Trump, to win back these states, to expand the map. And I felt that Joe Biden and maybe Pete Buttigieg were like the only people that could really do that. So it was a strategic decision that I made very early on, and it paid off. I'd like to say I was right, you know, considering that the election's over now, and you know, we flip back, we won over five states that Trump won in 2016, and hit 80 million. We're gonna on track to hit 80 million votes, first candidate ever to do that. So again, very proud to be a part of that. And then a story, speaking to my experience before the pandemic, I remember getting up on a Saturday morning in the middle of right after MLK Day of this year. It was like four or five college students. We woke up at 5 o'clock in the morning. None of us had cars, so we had to take the MARTA from the southwest side of Atlanta all the way to the north part, Lindbergh Station, up north of the city. It took about an hour to get there. And we were meeting Ray DeFrico and Robin Donaldson, who drove us to Columbia and Greenville, South Carolina, to knock on doors for Joe Biden. And what's really special about that was not only were we able to bond in that moment and become like this Team Joe for Georgia and be on, you know, the team from the early beginnings, but we were the only people organizing in Georgia and South Carolina at the time. And it's a great thing to, you know, have made phone calls with people that went on to create Facebook groups with 60,000 members from around the state of Georgia, or hosting someone for their first phone bank and then watch them become a field organizer. You know, like that kind of thing, watching us build that infrastructure that flipped Georgia by a little over 12,000 votes was just... it's going to be something that I'll never forget. The ups and downs of this year, just being a part of that in person and virtual. It was so special to me.
For a lot of students, their first time voting in a presidential election coincides with being away at college. And as you know, this makes campuses a really key site for voter mobilization. So what was the feeling like on campus during election season if the campus was actually virtual? What is the student voting culture like at Morehouse? And what are some of the things you did to encourage students to vote?
Yeah, so going back to like that part of earlier, I feel like there's life pre-pandemic and life post-pandemic, and they're two inherently different things. So before the pandemic, it really felt as if we were building momentum, you know, and just organizing students to get behind whoever the Democratic nominee ended up being. You know, it really felt like people were starting to become invested. All of my friends were for Senator Sanders or for Senator Warren, and I was kind of like the only one that was for Biden. Got a lot of flack for it, but you know, we saw towards, you know, the end of our time on campus that Biden was locking up the amount of delegates needed to secure the nomination, and people were gradually coming on board. Pandemic happens, threw everything off. All the momentum we thought we had kind of dissipated over time. And we went into the summer like, what's going on? You know, like, is this even a campaign? We were asking ourselves those questions. And then on a very serious and sincere, sad note, George Floyd was killed. And we had the summer of reckoning. And it really re-engaged people under, you know, I'd say 35, 18 to 25, that demographic, along with high school students. And you were seeing from all around the country. I remember going through my Instagram feed and seeing friends in Oakland, seeing friends in Detroit, seeing friends in Alabama, in Maryland, where I am, you know, mobilizing and uniting around the Black Lives Matter movement, uniting around, you know, these progressive policy positions. And we made it clear that we wanted to continue that momentum through the general. So organizing in the midst of the pandemic, we found that we had exhaust all options possible. Social media, panel discussions, any type of Zoom call you had. We had to do everything just to keep people engaged and interested, considering how high the stakes were in this case. And in doing so, towards the end, we definitely built some momentum. And I went down to Georgia right before the general. I was there for the month of October. We built a team of about 35 college students to do socially distanced door-to-door lit drops. People were excited to be a part of this movement, were excited to make phone calls, were excited to volunteer, sine wave, invest their time into this campaign. And I like to say young people won the state of Georgia. We had the highest youth voter turnout of any state. And then along with that, you know, young people won the election when you look at the margins. So we did this. Young people won this race.
When did this start to feel like a possibility for this, like that Georgia was going to go blue? I mean, your friend William Fairfax tweeted, when all is said and done and Georgia has been flipped blue, you know that Rick played a huge role in doing so. I mean, I love that tweet. And I'm just wondering, like, what it was like to be so central to this flipping, and when you started to really get a sense that, wow, this could actually happen, because those of us not in Georgia, I must say, we were pretty surprised. And so I'm wondering what it was like to be on the ground and be mobilizing the youth vote in the middle of this.
Yeah. Ooh, that's a great question. For me, I really thought that, you know, watching Stacey Abrams, in the official certified results coming short by 1.4%, going to a runoff in the Secretary of State's race in 2018, we smelt that there was blood in the water. We felt that the Republicans were only hanging on by a thread in Georgia, and that maybe it would take one more election cycle to flip it blue. And again, that was another reason why I wanted to unite around Joe Biden pretty early, because I felt that if anybody could win Georgia, it would be Joe Biden, appealing to people in the greater Atlanta suburbs, appealing to people like my grandmother, church-going, socially conservative, older Black woman who, you know, vote based off of, a lot of social positions. You know, I felt that demographic would be key in flipping a state like Georgia. And having conversations with people, we talked about this, we all agreed, you know, it did happen. And being on the ground for it, in terms of a moment where I realized that it was going to happen, was we did a sign waving event. This is late. This was very late. About 2 weeks before the general, a sign waving event on the Jackson Street Bridge. And we just posted it around Facebook. We said, how many people can we get out on a Wednesday afternoon in the middle of rush hour to just sine wave on this overpass over a highway? We got 45, 50 people sign waving on this bridge. People brought flags, banners, people had homemade signs, people brought their children to sign wave on the bridge. And it was just a very powerful moment. We had music and people were driving by and parking. They were like, can I have a sign? Can I join you? And we were getting honks from everywhere. U.S. Postal Service vans were honking at us. Like, it was just a very touching moment where you felt like, this could happen. You know, we were still in downtown Atlanta, but you just by the level of enthusiasm that we were generating, that was a moment where I definitely thought, you know, I think we can win this thing. And then the next couple of weeks, we just busted our tails, went to every single house, made every single phone call, no regrets. And we came away a little bit above 12,000 votes.
And you must have been exhausted. And now continuing, all eyes are on Georgia with these two crucial Senate races. What's it like being in the center of it again? And what's the situation like on the ground there? Are you still working with college students? What kinds of things are you doing at this point?
Right. So in terms of now transitioning to the runoff, during the general, we didn't really have the national audience, you know, like we have now. Like you said, all eyes are on Georgia and everyone is trying to figure out how they can help, which is a great thing. So everyone's calling me, texting friends in Georgia that are on the ground, like, how can we help? Can we donate? Can we phone call? So we come down and we're like, we don't even know yet. So just give us a couple days. So, you know, we've had a lot of those conversations, but there is this renewed enthusiasm again for John Ossoff and Reverend Warnock. You know, kind of the same feeling. Like it feels like we're building on what we just did and that we can bring them over the hump come January 5th. And then being in the middle of it, you know, and having such an important role in terms of youth vote outreach, my job isn't as difficult as it once was because youth are so invested in ensuring not just we're not satisfied that we just won the presidential race. You know, youth want to flip the state house in 2 years. Youth want to win these runoffs. Youth want to elect whoever runs for governor in 2022. I hope it's Stacey Abrams, but, you know, time will tell. But we're in this for the long haul. Young people are, and not just electing Democrats, but holding Democrats accountable once we elect them to office is really what we're seeing now. So being in the middle of that it's very powerful. We as young people do feel powerful as if we have a say. And we're going to continue to try to actualize that power that we have.
Can you talk a little bit about some of the problems that young people face voting, particularly college students? I've been struck by presentations on my campus where we have students who maybe don't live in North Carolina but are living on campus, and there's issues about where they're going to vote and which address they're going to use, how they're going to register. How have you seen those issues play out, and how are you helping to address them?
Yeah, so I think there's two issues, but they're wrapped into one. I think that because voting was such of critical importance in this cycle, you had everyone telling you to go vote. Twitter, Instagram, your aunt, your grandmother, the person at church. Everybody was telling you to vote, but it seemed as in this, it was everybody was telling you to vote a different way. So there was just a lot of confusion as to how do I cast a mail-in ballot? There was a story that broke my heart. It's a little funny, but it's just like, dude, like, what were you thinking? But there was a kid in Fulton County that I attend school with that voted in Ohio in Cuyahoga County, and he put his Cuyahoga County ballot in the Fulton County drop box in Atlanta. So there were things like that happening because everybody was hearing something different. You know, he knew he got his ballot, you know, he secured the ballot, this, that, and the other, but he mixed the instructions with something he had heard in Georgia. So, you know, it's just this sense of general sense of confusion as to once I request a ballot, then what? How do I request a ballot? If I go to vote in person, then what? What do I need to bring to the polls? You know, you had all these different audiences telling people what to do. I mean, in an effort to like mitigate that, to make it less confusing, what we did was we put infographics together on the campus of Morehouse. We sent out a three-step voter guide. You know, if you're going to vote early in person, this is what you do. If you're going to vote by mail, this is what you do. And if you're going to vote on election day, this is what you do. Just bullet points. Just trying to keep it as concise and simple as possible. That went out to our student body. Infographics posting on Instagram. You know, this is your mail-in ballot. When you send it, it should look like this if you're sending it to Fulton County Board of Elections. Panels, taking people from the Secretary of State's office, even though they're not the most well-trusted organization in Georgia. Now it seems like on both sides, you know, still bringing in somebody from the Secretary of State's office in to answer those hard questions. We did that at Morehouse. So we try to do everything that we could to try to make it as seamless and less confusing as possible.
One of the real challenges of being a college student in 2020 is that it's so hard to predict what the world is going to look like next month, let alone next year. But can you tell us what you think the future holds for you? What are your plans for spring semester, your senior year, and beyond?
Yeah. So for spring semester, I've applied to work virtually for the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, along with the Senate Banking Committee. So we'll see if I get those. And those will be virtual internships while I continue with school. I worked full time for the campaign while also going to school full time, which was insane. I don't know how I did that this past semester. So hopefully it won't be, you know, now that I have experience, you know, juggling both simultaneously, hopefully this spring won't be as bad. If I'm being frank, I would like to work in the the Biden White House in a fellowship capacity at some point over the course of the next 2 years. Just considering how long I was there, you know, what we were able to do, and really just identifying with that ticket so much, identifying with people that are going to go into the administration, friends that are going to go work for this administration. I want to work alongside them going forward. And then I'm thinking about taking off a gap semester to work on the 2022 midterms and then heading to law school in the fall of 2023. I mean, in the spring of 2023. And then following graduation from law school, I want to practice elections law. So when Harris County, Texas has one drop box for the fourth largest city in the country, we need to go to court over that. There should be multiple drop boxes in Houston, Texas, for example. When Georgia is taking off 15,000 voters from the voter registration roll, 70 to 80% of which happen to be African American, we need to take that to court. So that's what I want to do after graduating from law school. And then who knows what happens from there, maybe running for public office one day, serving in some capacity. Who knows what happens.
Oh, Rick, the world needs you. It's been so inspiring to have this conversation. Thank you for spending time with us.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. I really appreciated it. Enjoyed the conversation.
Wow, Lisa, what a powerful interview. I really enjoyed that. And I was thinking as I was listening about what an important place college campuses are for people in terms of sort of political education and civic training. There have been a lot of talk lately about how we really need to think about how we as a country educate people in civics. And Rick Hart is on the job, right? And college campuses are really places where people vote for the first time. This is kind of a demographic thing, right? A lot of students go to college right after high school. They're 18 years old. And at some point in their 4 years, they're likely to have an opportunity to vote in a presidential election.
I know. And it's so interesting because we don't think of college students usually as being a core early constituency for a candidate like Biden. Yet Rick and his friends were getting up at 5 a.m, even before Biden got the nomination to campaign for him in South Carolina. I thought it was so interesting how Rick was really strategic in his thinking. Ideologically, he was more in line with Sanders and Warren, but he believed that Biden could gain the support of people like his grandmother, right? And then there was the murder of George Floyd. And I thought it was so important how Rick talked about that moment as such a mobilizing one for youth. And they turned that energy that they generated on the streets into energy for the election.
So you really see the connection there between the movement for Black Lives that has been so important in 2020. You know, that's a very youth-oriented movement as well. That is a movement that has been very intentional about making sure that youth are enfranchised in the movement and are being trained and see this as theirs. And I was really blown away by Rick saying, "We feel like we have a voice." That gave me chills, actually.
And so, listeners, we suspected that you'd want to know about Rick's involvement in the Georgia Senate elections in January. And so we followed up with him a few days after that election. Rick Hart, welcome back to College Land. Congratulations on the victory in Georgia that you worked so hard to secure.
Thank you so much, Lisa. We did it. We pulled it off. And I'm so glad to be back. Thank you for inviting me again.
You were the Young Georgians Engagement Director for Raphael Warnock. Can you tell us a little bit about how you got that position and what it entailed?
Sure. I'll go all the way back, I guess. So I started volunteering for the Biden campaign in October of 2019. I made my way into a fellowship internship-like capacity in the spring of 2020, continued to work. And then towards the end of the general, I found myself working to manage 30 other college students around the state of Georgia in various fellowship capacities for the Biden campaign. And when we were, when all the votes came in and we were finally victorious in Georgia by a little less than 12,000 votes, I was reached out to by one of our coalition's directors from the Biden campaign in Georgia, who asked, hey, do you want to continue this? Do you want to go 2 for 2 in Georgia this election cycle? Do you want to be our youth vote coordinator with the Warnock campaign? And I instantly said yes. There was no hesitation in my mind whatsoever. I knew we had to get this done because the legislative legacy for at least the first 2 years of this Biden-Harris administration depended on us winning these runoff races, and I wanted to be a part of the movement to get that done and to make it happen.
Fantastic. Can you tell me a little bit about what you did with youth voters on campuses and beyond as part of this work, and basically what it all entailed?
Yeah, so essentially my purview in terms of age demographic was anybody between the ages of 18 and 35, along with high school students, you know, students who aren't able to vote yet, but are, have been become increasingly active, especially in this election cycle. So as part of that, what I did, especially towards the end, was when we traveled, when the Reverend traveled, my job was to make sure that in every town we went to, we had 20 to 40 students that were ready to listen to the Rev's remarks and ready to go canvas, knock on doors, ready to make phone calls. We were just trying to get as many youth tapped into the campaign to get involved as possible. In terms of virtual events, we had a series of virtual events. We had an HBCU sit down with Sheila Jackson Lee and Reverend Warnock, hosted by Yvette Nicole Brown of NBC's A Community. We had an international rally that was put on by Somalian, Eritrean, and Ethiopian youth in Stone Mountain in DeKalb County, in which we saw over 600 people come out to hear remarks from John Ossoff, Reverend Warnock, and our candidate for Public Service Commissioner Daniel Blackman. We had a Twitch game night where we played Among Us, and we played Uno with the Rev, John Ossoff, Daniel Blackman in a series of Twitch streamers, which I was able to host an hour of, which was super fun, and I enjoyed every second of it. And we hosted in-state and out-of-state phone banks every day of the week. So we had a North phone bank, a Southeast phone bank, a West phone bank, and a Heartland Midwest phone bank, where we brought on surrogates such as Bob Casey. We brought on Congresswoman Maxine Waters, incoming senator from the state of California, Alex Padilla. And we got our goal was to just get as many young people engaged to volunteer and to devote their time towards the campaign, which could translate to votes on behalf of John Ossoff and Reverend Warnock. And we did it pretty successfully, I would say.
Wow, you are incredibly busy. As a parent of a teenager who spends a lot of time playing Among Us, I can really applaud you for the creative way that you are thinking about engaging this demographic in the work. I think it's really fascinating how campaigns are evolving to meet people where they are. And it certainly seems like you did a lot of that in this time period. And I'm wondering if you could talk about how the experiences you've had really in the past year, mm-hmm. how they have affected the way you see the role of students in US politics, both now and in the future.
A saying that I have developed, at least in my own psyche over the course of this last year, is that not only are young leaders, students, the leaders of tomorrow, but they're also the leaders of today. And when students go vote, when young people go vote, progressive candidates win elections. When we turn out in record numbers, when we turn out in high numbers, the values that we espouse as a generation, whether it be Gen Z or millennials, are put into office. And you definitely saw that in Georgia, where we set a record youth voter turnout in November. I believe 21% of voters were between the ages of 18 to 35, which was a record in the state of Georgia and the highest youth vote turnout of any state in the country. And we were able to pull off some historic wins. So again, when young people vote, progressive candidates win elections and change happens.
What was it like in Georgia when you found out that Warnock had won? Can you take us back to that moment or series of moments? Where were you? How did you find out? What happened?
Yeah. So I'll preface this by saying our entire staff, the entire campaign staff, was COVID tested the day before. So we were able to be around each other that night. And we had this space in Atlanta called the Gathering Spot where we watched the election results. And, you know, we were very shocked at first because it wasn't aware to a lot of us that Fulton County, the city of Atlanta and other places, we're going to count their mail-in ballots first as opposed to last. We expect it to be
right.
8, 10, 12 points, you know, and then, you know, bite into that lead as time went on. So when we polls closed in Fulton County and within 20 minutes, we were up statewide by 15 points. We're like, what is happening? but we knew from there that our lead would narrow throughout the night. And it did, obviously. And there was a point in which Senators Leffler and Perdue took the lead very briefly and very narrowly. But what we knew was that all of the outstanding vote when Senators Perdue and Leffler took the lead by less than 2 points, let's say, was coming from Metro Atlanta. DeKalb County, the city of Atlanta, Fulton County, and Cobb County, you know, another suburb that has swung in our direction increasingly in recent years. So we knew that we could win. But then finally, when we saw, it was probably a little after 11 o'clock when CNN took both the Rev and John Ossoff, their numbers shot above Leffler and Perdue's, and all of the outstanding vote was from Greater Atlanta. We knew we won in that moment. You're just hugging everybody. People were crying. We were just so proud. It was just that atmosphere of we did it. We pulled this off. And the Senate's going to have a 50-50 balance. And Vice President Kamala Harris is going to be the tie-breaking vote on landmark legislation for the next 2 years. And to know that I played a part in that and that my teammates played a part in that, I couldn't be more grateful to be able to experience this.
Oh, I'm getting chills just hearing about it. Yeah. It'd be hard to imagine a more intense moment in U.S. politics than this one. And you've had a front row seat for really the hopeful parts. How has the experience of working on the 2020 election campaigns changed you? What do you know now that you want everyone to know as we turn to the future?
Wow. That's a great question, Lisa. I guess the first thing I'll say is, you have a lot of people that are just very cynical about the power of their individual vote. And in a state like Georgia, where we just saw some of the most, probably our most important presidential election ever, followed by our most two important Senate races ever, coming off of very narrow wins, we do get to see the power of one person's singular vote, quite frankly, matter. You know, a lot of young people don't think that their votes matter. But increasingly, especially over the course of these past 4 years under the administration of Donald Trump, young people are energized and engaged more so than ever and are beginning to understand the power of turning out in record numbers as a collective. And again, when that happens, we win. And that's one thing I'll take with me for the rest of my time working in politics, probably for the rest of my life, is that every single vote down to the single, to the last one, really does indeed matter.
Rickard, thank you for those words of wisdom and for the work you've done to protect and strengthen our democracy. I'm really excited to hear and see what the future holds for you.
Thank you so much. Again, it was great talking to you, Lisa, and hopefully this isn't the last time.
Absolutely. Take care.
You too.
I have a feeling that this is not the last we will hear about Rickard. He's an exceptional individual for sure, but he's also the product of a whole lot of love and intention over generations, including the home and place of shelter, as he put it, of the HBCUs. Listeners, do you have an experience with mobilizing voters at an HBCU or another experience with voting on campus that you'd like to share? We want to hear from you. Our email is collegelandpod@gmail.com. You can also reach us on Facebook and Twitter at CollegeLandPod. And now for the segment we're calling Office Hours, in which we answer listener questions about higher education. Today's question is from a listener who wants to know what we think about the certificate program being offered by Google that the company says will replace the need for a traditional 4-year bachelor's degree.
So Google's offering 3 new certificates in data analytics, project management, and user experience design, which will join their existing IT support and IT automation in Python certificates. Hosted on the online education platform Coursera, these programs are developed in-house and they're taught by Google employees, and they require no previous experience at all. And to help cover their cost, Google is going to fund 100,000 what they call need-based scholarships. And they're going to offer students, again, in Google's words, hundreds of apprentice opportunities at the company to provide real on-the-job training. So none of this is going to guarantee any given student a job, but Google representatives say that they're going to consider their new career certificates as the equivalent of a four-year degree. So Nan, what do you think about this?
Well, I have a lot of different thoughts about this, but first, I guess I would say that anyone who can get a job in this economy, I say go you. The pandemic has disrupted so many people's ability to work or to work in decent jobs, and I can totally see the appeal of picking up a certificate that people think is going to land them some work soon. I say go for it.
But, you know, we're also concerned about the potential for exploitation here, right? I mean, do other companies take these certificates, or does this tie someone to working for Google? Because the capacity for mobility is part of what gives workers power. The Google certificate program creates a different kind of lack of mobility. Unless it's an industry-wide change, it could make workers beholden to the company.
Yeah, and there's also the kind of the issue of like the long-term marketability of the certificate, right? Google says that these certificates are in high-paying, high-growth career fields. That's a quote. But the current job market is really one that is changing rapidly, especially in tech. And so fields that are booming today will not likely be booming a decade from now. And particular technological skills that people might gain might be out of date in a few years. So one of the things about a college degree is that you get trained to be flexible.
Right. One of the things we offer in colleges and universities is a liberal arts education, and that provides students with what are known as transferable skills. So things like critical thinking, collaboration, effective writing and speaking. These are skills that we know that employers of all kinds say that they're looking for. And while we can't predict the kinds of jobs that will be available in 20 years, we can say with some certainty that these kinds of transferable skills are going to remain highly desirable to employers. So I guess if I was hedging my bets and I had equal opportunity and equal circumstances to pursue a Google certificate or a liberal arts education at a four-year college, I think I would still come down on the side of the college, even as the Google certificate is quite appealing on its face.
Yeah. And by the way, Google workers have just started a union and Google workers are unionizing to push for pay equity. They're protesting against unfair machine learning, or in other words, the way that prejudice is created and perpetuated through algorithms, and also against sexual assault. And so I just am a little suspicious, you know, is it possible that this new certificate program at Google is an anti-union effort, an attempt to like flood the labor pool at Google with people so that the established workers feel they could be easily replaced? It's, I don't know, but it's something to consider.
Wow, that's a kind of sinister view. I hadn't thought of that, Nan.
But I got a dark imagination.
Certainly a possibility. So, I mean, what can we say to wrap up here, Nan?
I guess I would say what might be kind of an opportunistic move on Google's part is actually taking advantage of the crisis in higher education. Because for somebody in the pandemic to be looking at a choice between a course that might cost them $400 and 4 years of college that could be costing $100,000. It's just, how can you make that kind of choice? So the cost of college is such a huge problem, right? It's something that we're going to be talking about in college land. And so while we're worried about Google, do you know, the real point, I guess, since I don't have anything to, I don't have any power at Google, you know, the main thing that we want to say is, wow, do we need to make college affordable again?
That's it for today from College Land. If you like what you've heard, please write us a review. And if you have thoughts about Google, or you have ideas for our segments or questions for our office hours, please send them to us at collegelandpod@gmail.com or get in touch on Facebook or Twitter at collegelandpod.
Thanks to our producer, the wonderful Rochelle Wilson, and to Wisconsin Humanities for their support.
Thanks for visiting College Land.